Well, good evening. If I could have you go ahead and find your seats. We sure appreciate you coming and being a part of this evening on behalf of Faith Bible Church. We do thank you. We're excited to have Lawrence Hebron here as he's a part of our church. And he's going to be exposing Islam. And we're excited about understanding and hearing more about that. And hopefully you'll be encouraged as well. I'm not sure how long ago, probably about a year or so ago, he came up to me, and we call him Larry, so if you call him Lawrence, you'll understand who we're talking about. Probably about a year and a half ago, he came up to me and told me he was going to write a book on Islam, and really, I was new to the church, didn't know much about him, and said, okay, that was nice, and then a few months later, he called me up and said, hey, let's go to lunch. And he told me about his book, and he started explaining all the different things he learned about Islam, and it was pretty neat for me. I enjoyed it. I felt as I was listening to him, there's a lot of things that we hear about Islam that maybe aren't as accurate as maybe they should be, and I really appreciate his vantage point. He's not someone that read multiple other books on Islam and then digested that. He's someone that went into their sacred materials, as he'll tell you more about that. And then from doing that, he came up with his own opinions about what they teach, and I thought it was really good, and I enjoyed it. Very insightful. While he was telling me this and while he was explaining to me the premise of Islam, the first thing that came to my mind is that this is a very distorted, very a strange religion, perverted, if you will. As he goes in and explains more detail, you'll understand my whole point. But as I was thinking about that, I started thinking, well, that would be natural. You understand that we are a church and we believe that Jesus Christ is our Lord and Savior. And for those who believe that Christ is their Lord and Savior, you have a system of thought in your mind. God is producing a way of thinking. Without that thought, without Christ inside you, you're going to have the world system. And so when we hear about Islam, when we hear about other religions, we hear that this is the world system. This is what is inherently true about sin nature, inherently true about man. So as you spend time and you hear about Islam and you learn about really what they teach, and it might be a bit challenging for you, might be discouraging. Some of you might be experts. You might already know everything there is to know about it. But I think for me, the next thought is, what do you do with it? What do you do with that information? He is going to offer an additional class afterwards. But my regards are this. What's wrong with Islam is they don't have Christ. They need Christ. The problem is not, and I know as you hear these things, you might be inflamed, you might be angry, you might be start wanting to act out against them. And I want you to understand, their problem is not that they hate us. The problem is that they hate Christ, and they need Christ. And so as we learn more about them, and we certainly should learn about them, the next thing we need to do is pray for them, pray for their salvation. Pray for their understanding so that they might understand that they are in a false religion and they need Christ. If there's anyone here in this room this evening that has never put their faith in Christ, what we're about as a church is realizing and understanding that there's no way to work or earn your way to God's approval. No matter how good you might be or how good you might think you are, God is not in favor of you. God is not pleased with your works. God will actually have to judge you. And the only way that we can find salvation is through the works of Christ, through faith in his work. So as we listen tonight, as we hear Lawrence speak about Islam, understand that the answer to Islam is Christ. And the answer to those maybe who are out here this morning that or this evening that don't have Christ is Christ as well. So this time I'm going to open us up in a word of prayer. Do I need to stall a little more? We're good? All right, let's open us up in a word of prayer and we'll let you get started. Father, we do thank you for the opportunity that we have. We thank you for Lawrence that spent time to understand Islam and just to be able to help us understand the ins and out of this false religion. Father, I pray that you might guide and direct our heart. Father, I pray that you might help us understand. And Father, I pray that you might help us love. Love someone that doesn't love us. Father, the only way that we could ever love someone that doesn't love us is through you in us. And we pray, Lord, that you might help us do that. Give us understanding. Be with Lawrence for your honor and your glory. In Jesus' name, amen. A warm welcome.
Well, thank you for that welcome. I appreciate that a lot. And Pastor, thank you. Thank you for that very nice introduction. That's great. And I also want to express my thanks to Faith Bible for opening up for this event. This demonstrates a kind of courage that a lot of congregations don't have. And I know because I've been around to a lot of them. The book came out just recently, and one of the things I thought I would do is go around to the different congregations in the area and offer the opportunity to hear this presentation as you will hear it tonight. Very few have accepted, but I especially remember the conversation I had with one lead pastor over in Redlands. I went in, and I introduced myself, and I explained what this was about, and I mentioned the title of the book, Islam Exposed, What You Need to Know About the World's Most Dangerous Religion. Right away, you felt the ambient temperature of the room drop about 12 degrees Celsius. You could feel the shields go up. Her body language and her expression changed, very suspicious look. And with a very accusatory tone, she said, well, that's kind of an inflammatory title, don't you think? Did you have an agenda for writing this book? And I said, yes. My agenda was nothing more and nothing less than to tell the truth. And that's what we're going to do tonight. You're going to learn the truth about Islam. Now, that's kind of a bold statement, especially when there's so much confusion about it. But let me tell you why I can make that statement. First of all, let me tell you that I did not set out to write a book on Islam. I've written a few other things. I didn't set out to write a book on Islam. I didn't even have any interest in studying Islam, frankly. I'm a Christian. I'd rather spend my time plumbing the depths of my own religion. But then, doggone it, the Muslims kept literally exploding themselves into our lives, often at the expense of our lives. And it was obvious that once again, Islam had become a front burner issue in world affairs. Now, I was familiar with Islam and the effects of it and a little bit about it because I've been interested in history and politics and government and things like that for 50 years I've been studying, since the mid-60s. And of course, Islam would come up, but usually back then in the context of the Middle East and in the context of relations with Israel. But in more recent decades, it has been reaching out into what we might call our world. And I thought, I need to know more about this. I had opinions. I had come to certain conclusions. But the fact was, I didn't have a great deal of confidence in what I knew and what I believed. And so I felt I need to dig deeper. There are so many issues and so many debates that are going on right now. Is Islam a religion of peace that has been hijacked by violent extremists, contrary to the teachings of Muhammad? Or is it a cult of death that's being true to its tenets? I thought I knew the answer to that, but I didn't have much confidence in my answer. And what about groups like ISIS, Al-Qaeda? What about Boko Haram, Hamas, Islamic Brotherhood? Were these examples of extreme or mainstream Islam? Again, I had an opinion, but I didn't have much confidence in the opinion. So about 5 years ago, I resolved that I was going to study. I was going to get some information. Now, a lot of my training is as a historian, and historians always like to go back to source materials, original documents. So I thought, okay, I'll start my study by reading the Quran. So I even made sure I got a translation of the Quran that would be acceptable to the Muslims. It was written by an English-speaking Muslim. And my understanding is a pretty well-respected translation. That may have been a mistake. Starting your study of Islam by reading the Quran is a little bit like learning how to swim by being dropped in the ocean 5 miles offshore on a stormy day. It is not an easy read. I'll tell you this, though. I didn't get very far before I started to have some feelings of hopefulness. There were some very positive remarks in there. Good things about Christians, good things about Jews, hopeful remarks. I thought, wow, this would be great because I would really like to think that there could be a reconciliation. I'd really like to think that the extremists are a very small number. And we could maybe pluck them out of the barrel like a bad apple before it made everything else go bad. I would like to think that. And there were some remarks that seemed to support that. But then there were other remarks that weren't so tolerant, weren't so compassionate, remarks that were absolutely savage and brutal and completely intolerant. And I thought, how do you make sense of this? How do you reconcile this? I didn't know. And so I ended my first read of the Quran with more questions than when I started. Well, that didn't accomplish my goal of understanding Islam better, so it kind of pulled me in. And I started reading other things, commentaries and histories and other things like that. And I learned that there are actually three primary sources that the Muslims use for everything from their theology, Sharia law, how they deal with others, outsiders, all the way down to which shoe they're supposed to put on first and which direction they spit if they have to spit when they're saying their prayers. I'm not kidding. That's all covered. Now, if we can have the next slide, please. Unfortunately, somehow in the translation, we missed the middle one here, so you're going to have to trust me on what it is. But it's in Arabic anyway, and unless any of you can read Arabic, I think we have one over here who can, but it's not going to matter too much. So let's start here. The three major sources. Actually, there's two areas. This one we would have to consider as being divine. That's the Quran. That's the one pretty much all of you are familiar with. The Quran is a collection of 114 allegedly divine revelations that are called surahs, S-U-R-A. I emphasize that because there's another word we're going to be using that sounds very similar to that. Allegedly divine revelations that came from Allah, the God, through the angel Gabriel, yeah, our Gabriel, to Muhammad. And that's what you find in here. And these are more like the sacred writings. And that they use that for some guidance. But the Quran actually constitutes less than 20% of the total amount of text that Muslims use to guide them. In addition to that are the Sunnah. Now, Sunnah refers to the traditions. And to find out what they're all about, you look at these two sources. Again, this one's kind of mysterious right here. Something happened in emailing this over. Now, the one over here on the right are the Hadith. The word hadith means a narrative or an account. These are basically snapshots from the life of Muhammad. They're eye and ear witness accounts. Muhammad said this. I heard Muhammad say this. I saw Muhammad do this. Okay? So most of them are very short. There's alleged to be over 300,000 of them. A lot of them are repetitive. Most of them are very short, a line or two. Some are short stories. Of that 300,000 plus, about 30,000 are considered to be fairly authoritative, and they narrow that down to about 3,000 or 4,000 that they use for the most part. And there are certain, what they call traditionists, we would probably call historians or editors who put this information together. So these are snapshots in the life of Muhammad. Now, about a century after the death of Muhammad, he died in 632, so the 7th century. In the 8th century, a man named Ibn Ishaq went through and collected a lot of these hadith. He vetted them, tried to see how authoritative they are, and then put them together in the biography, basically the authorized biography of Muhammad. It's called Sirat Rasul Allah, or Sirah for short. That sounds a lot like Surah. So we won't get those confused. This now, if these are the snapshots, this is the motion picture. Beginning of his life through the end of his life. And since Muhammad is the model Muslim, since he's the example you're supposed to follow, these sources combined are very important because they tell you what that model is. He led the perfect Muslim life. So if you're a Muslim, you're supposed to follow his example. And that's what these sources are doing. Now, having said that, we're just about ready to kick off. A couple last administrative notes. I'm going to go through a lot of quotes. The book has over 400 quotes in them, and upwards of 95% of them are from one of these three sources. That's why I can say you are going to hear the truth about Islam because it's coming from their authoritative sources. It's just like if you say, well, what did Jesus believe? Well, if you quote from John, here it says this. Okay, that's pretty authoritative, right? That's what I'm doing. That's why I rely on these. They can't argue with what's in there. If it's in there, they may not want you to know it, but they can't deny it. Okay? Now, at the bottom, so this presentation could be a lot shorter if we didn't go through so many quotes. We're not going through all 400, believe me. But if I didn't do this, then it would sound an awful lot like Lawrence Hebron's opinion, Lawrence Hebron's conclusion. I want you to be able to walk out those doors tonight with the same kind of confidence that I now have, because you have heard it from the horse's mouth, in effect. You have seen it right from the source. And you will have confidence in what you have seen and what you have heard. At the bottom of the quote, you'll see one of three references. You might see something like Quran 9:5. That means it's from the Quran, the ninth surah, again there are 114, and verse number 5. If it says Sirah, S-I-R-A, then it's from Sirat Rasul Allah, the life of Allah's messenger. Sirah is a shortening of Sirat. And then it'll have a number like maybe 592. That's from section 592. That book is divided into sections. Each section is roughly, we would equate it to a paragraph or two. And then if it says like a name like Bukhari or Muslim, and then there's like two or three numbers after that, that means it's from Bukhari's collection, maybe book such and such, volume such and such, verse such and such. Okay, I'm sure you're not going to remember all that stuff, but I want you to show this is authoritative. This is where it comes from. This is where we're getting the information. One last administrative note. Sometimes in the quotations, you will see a remark in brackets. If it's in rounded brackets or parentheses, I did not put that in there. That's something the traditionist, the editor, the historian put in over 1,000 years ago to make sure the reader understood it. So I'm not trying to slant your interpretation. They're trying to guide your interpretation so you have an accurate one. If you see it in square brackets, I did put that in, so you would know what they're talking about. Every now and then you have a pronoun like they. Well, who are they? Well, in the Sirah, it might have been two paragraphs before. I don't want to have you go through all three paragraphs to see who they are. So I'll just say they, and then the adult male Jews from Bani Kareza or something like that. Then you'll know what that is. Okay? Well, with that, let's get underway. Next slide, please. If you want to understand Islam, do not study the Quran. You study the life of Muhammad. Know him, and you know Islam. Now, right away, some of you might be thinking, and if we had Muslims in here, or Muslim apologists, they might be saying right off the bat, wait a minute, time out, Hebron, you barely opened your mouth, you've just started, and the first thing you said is a lie. Islam is not about Muhammad, it's about Allah. Well, theoretically, that is correct. Practically, no. Think about it. Virtually everything that a Muslim thinks he or she knows about Allah came from or through Muhammad. The Quran, allegedly from Allah, but through Muhammad. It was what he said it was. He said, Allah told me. The Hadith, what Muhammad said and what he did. Sirat Rasulullah, a compilation of hadith. It's what Muhammad did and what he said. It's all about Muhammad. If you want to have a practical knowledge, and I'm not talking about their theology, if you want to hear about the theology, this young lady over here, Stephanie Ziegler, is an expert on that. My presentation here is on practical matters. Just like the title says, what you need to know about the world's most dangerous religion. If you want to know what they're about, study Muhammad. If you want to know what they're going to do, study Muhammad. If you want to know how this is going to affect you, study Muhammad. He is the model Muslim. He is the exemplar, the example that everyone else is supposed to follow. If he said it, you should believe it. If he did it, you may too. So let's see what he said and what he did. And Muhammad even helped us out here, as he often did. He quoted Allah, who was always talking to him. And one of the things that Allah told him was, "Verily, in Allah's apostle, you have a good example." In other words, follow this example, and you'll see that more and more too. So right in here. It'd almost be like if I came up to you and said, "You know what? God's been talking to me, and he said that I'm his favorite, and you should listen to me and do everything that I tell you." Because that's what God said. That's basically what Muhammad is saying here. And not only is this just for Muslims or people from Arabia or from Persia. Look at what it says here down at the bottom. "Every prophet was sent to his nation, but only I have been sent to all mankind." All mankind, whether you like it or not. Well, that being the case, let's start our examination of the life of Muhammad. Next slide, please. First of all, the name Muhammad means praiseworthy. His full name is right here. I'm not going to read it because I'd probably butcher it, and it would take up half the evening. So you probably want to get home before midnight. He was born in the town of Mecca, which at the time was already an influential metropolitan area. It was influential as culture, religion, and economics. He was born in the year of the elephant, which we think was probably 570 AD. So to put this in a historical context, about 5.5 centuries after the birth of Christ. Okay? And he died June 8, 632. Next slide, please. Muhammad's father's name was Abdullah, which means slave of Allah. Yep, the name Allah, the concept of Allah existed before Muhammad, but it was not nearly as defined. It was just sort of one of those other gods floating around there, along with 359 others that we'll hear about in a little bit. But his father died when his mother was pregnant. He never knew his father. His mother died when he was only 6. His grandfather took over raising him, but he died when he was only 8. And thereafter, Muhammad was raised by his uncle Abu Talib. Now, a psychiatrist would have a field day with this information right in here. It would tell you a lot. But I'm not going to go into that area. I'm just going to go with the documentation. Okay. Now, this is already critical information. Let's see why. Next slide, please. Muhammad was born into one of the clans of the Quraysh tribe. This was a very powerful and influential tribe in and around Mecca for two reasons. One, the Quraysh was powerful. They were a powerful class of merchants, so they had a great deal of economic wealth and therefore economic power. But also they had responsibility for tending to the religious articles and artifacts in and around Mecca, including the famous Kaaba. You'll see that spelled different ways. I do kind of an English version. That is the famous cubicle building that you'll sometimes see them marching around in a counterclockwise direction when they go on their pilgrimages. This building was allegedly built by Abraham and his son Ishmael. Not Isaac, but Ishmael. Okay? And allegedly, the Quraysh tribe are descendants from Ishmael. So they had religious and economic significance in the area. All right, next slide, please. Muhammad learned from his uncle and soon became a very savvy and successful businessman. As a young adult, he was hired by a lady named Khadija, who was the widow of one of his distant cousins. Among other things, she hired him to handle her various business affairs, which took him up to Syria. So he learned about the caravan routes, he learned about making money, but also, when he came up into Syria, this brought him into contact with a large population of Christians and Jews, which were established around the area. Virtually no Christians and Jews in around Mecca. Now, Muhammad was already had a kind of a spiritual bent. He was very interested in the religions of Saudi Arabia, had studied them, and now this brought him into contact with these traditions, and you'll see how this is going to start to have an important influence on him. Next slide, please. As I said, he had an affinity for spiritual matters. He was well-versed in the various religions of his native Arabia. Many years later, when he would have his version of the cleansing of the temple, he kind of had the cleansing of the Kaaba when he returned on his triumphal reentry to Mecca. He took out the idols that were in and around the Kaaba. There were 360 of them, so basically like 360 gods that were worshipped in and around Arabia. They were fairly tolerant of these religions at that time. They were not an intolerant people, but there were a lot of them. But now he became exposed to the Judeo-Christian tenets, their teachings, and this would definitely be woven into this new religion that he was going to unleash upon the world, Islam. Well, with that background, let's talk about the first major phase of his life. Why do we even worry about Muhammad? It's because of what happened in these next two phases. So next slide, please. First of all, we're going to talk about the Messiah of Mecca. Muhammad, as we said, was a very spiritual man. He often had an annual retreat out into the desert, Mount Hira. He would sometimes stay there for weeks and meditate. But in the year 610, next slide, please, he had an unusual visitation. During the month of Ramadan, at the age of approximately 40, he claimed to have had an angelic visitor. He first thought he was going crazy and even considered suicide. But the angel reassured him with these words. He said, "Oh, Muhammad, you are the apostle of Allah, and I am Gabriel." Yep, same Gabriel of the Old and New Testament. Well, Gabriel starts talking to Muhammad. He starts passing information to Muhammad from Allah. At least that's what Muhammad was saying. Next slide, please. At first, Muhammad only shared this information with a group of close friends, family members. His first convert was Khadijah. That's the lady he used to work for. She became his first wife. But then, as we see down here, God commanded his apostle to declare the truth of what he had received and to make known his commands to men and to call them to him. So now it was no longer sufficient to just share this information with a small group of people. Now he was called to go out and proselytize, to evangelize, to spread the word. And he did. Now remember, this area was already used to lots of religions, and they had been very tolerant of them. And initially they said, you know, what the heck? You know, 361, what difference does one more make? But Muhammad was not tolerant of them. It was pretty much my way or the highway, because he presented himself as Allah's mouthpiece, and if I say it, it's from God, and you need to obey it. Next slide, please. Muhammad presented himself as the true messenger of Allah, whose word must be obeyed as though it were Allah's himself, because according to Muhammad, it was. When Muhammad spoke, it's like Allah is speaking. And you see this message. Now, one of the things you'll see throughout this evening is Muhammad successfully employed a classic technique of brainwashing, which is endless repetition. Repeat, 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 repeat. We're going to see this in lots of different areas. One of the things that Muhammad did very successfully was he tried to link himself with Allah so that when you saw him, you saw Allah, and when you thought of Allah, you thought of Muhammad. We see this message. Obey God and obey the messenger. That's from Quran, the 24th surah. That same message shows up six times in one surah. Almost the identical words. Sometimes a little variation. Obey God and obey me. Obey God and obey me, because we're one and the same. That message over and over and over again. And because of that, again, he was not at all tolerant of other contrary opinions. Next slide, please. As a result of this lack of tolerance, Muhammad pretty successfully alienated most of the people of Mecca. As one outraged Meccan put it, "Muhammad has cursed our gods, insulted our religion, mocked our way of life, and accused our forefathers of error." Well, as you might guess, with an attitude like that, he ticked off a lot of people. They were very unhappy with him in Mecca. They couldn't do much to Muhammad because he was protected by his powerful uncle Abu Talib. You've probably heard about some of these societies where if you have a powerful relative, they kind of protect you as long as they're around. So they couldn't do a whole lot to Muhammad, but they could to his followers. And they did. They started to persecute them. So much to the point that Muhammad started to send them out. Oh, I'm sorry, next slide, please. First, he sent some into exile in Abyssinia, and then later to Medina, which is about 210 miles north and slightly west of Mecca. Then, after 13 years of failure in Mecca, Muhammad himself had to go into exile. His uncle had died. The protection was gone. Now, let's summarize these 13 years very quickly. In 13 years of concentrated effort, scholars indicate that Muhammad was able to successfully recruit about 185 to 300 followers. In other words, Muhammad was phenomenally unsuccessful as a religious leader, a total failure, and finally got run out of town, not quite on a rail, but for all practical purposes, the same thing. Now he's gone up to Medina. Medina, though, is going to be critical. This next phase of his life is where everything starts to change. And this is where we're really going to see the shape and nature of Islam start to come together. Next slide, please. Because now he goes from the Messiah of Mecca to the warlord of Medina. The first year or so in Medina was very, very difficult for Muhammad and his Muslims. They lived on the verge of starvation. They lived in great poverty. They were barely getting by. But it still was an important period. Next slide, please. Because they did have a chance to survive, regroup, and recover. Even though it was tough for them, they weren't being persecuted like they had been down in Mecca. Also during this time, it's very important because, next slide, the formal character of Islam began to develop. We see the institution of the prayer, the alms tax, the fasting were all instituted. Elements of Sharia law began to emerge. But also, and this will be critical too, tensions began to grow between Muhammad and the Christians and the Jews. We'll talk more about that a little bit later. But basically what happened was Muhammad sought to weave himself into the prophetic history of the Jews and the Christians. He basically tried to establish his authority and validate himself by saying, I'm the next link in this chain of prophets. All of those Old Testament prophets, right down through, including Jesus, I'm the next and, oh, by the way, the greatest link in that chain. So he tied himself to this Judeo-Christian tradition. Down in Mecca, there were almost no Christians and Jews to contest that. When he went up to Medina, there were a lot of Christians and Jews, and they said, well, wait a minute, what are you doing here? The story doesn't go like that. So either the Christians and Jews were wrong or Muhammad was, and he didn't take too kindly to thinking to the idea that he was wrong. He was Allah's spokesperson. He couldn't be wrong. So they must be, and now they became enemies. We see this tension start to grow. Next slide, please. It was also during this time that Muhammad developed the model for Islamic expansion throughout the future. And that was, next slide, jihad. Jihad. Now, as I said, during this time, during that first year or so, there was a great deal of poverty. They were just barely getting by. But then Muhammad got a very convenient download from Allah. You see that happening a lot. Muhammad was also often given permission to do things that other people weren't allowed to do. Anything from how many wives you're allowed to have, whether or not you're allowed to kill in Mecca, whether or not you're allowed to burn the crops of other communities, right on down the line. And here he got a divine revelation that said, you know what, it's okay for you to go out and do those things that are illegal for others, including stealing and killing. Now remember his history. Muhammad came from the Quraysh. They were merchants. They conducted a lot of travel and a lot of business with other areas, including Syria. Muhammad had participated in these. He had gone on these caravans. He knew the caravan routes. He knew how they traveled. He knew when they traveled. He knew where they traveled. He knew what kind of security they had. He knew all the ins and outs. And so he arranged for a raiding party. They went out and attacked one of these caravans. They stole all their things, all their goods, and killed everybody there so nobody could go back and report who had done this to them. Because his Muslims were still a small group, they were very vulnerable. This started the pattern. Now, when he came back, he divided up the booty. For the first time, they've got a little wealth to play with. The formula that quickly developed was this. Muhammad always got one-fifth. The other four-fifths were distributed, sometimes for humanitarian purposes, if you can really call it humanitarian, when it's ill-gotten goods. But they did take care of widows and orphans and things like that. But the people who participated in the raid were always very generously rewarded. And this is when the Islamic community started to grow, when people saw they could make a profit off of it. And I'll talk more about that here in just a minute. Next slide, please. So during this time, Muhammad evolved from a failed religious leader into a successful warlord. He used economic warfare to weaken his enemies, fill his coffers, entice new converts, strike fear in the hearts of future targets, and expand his religious and geographic kingdom. And this would be a model for future generations. Now, let me go back up to this one. I already mentioned it a little bit. There's a fellow I know who was a fairly high-ranking naval intelligence officer who was involved in both our operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. And a few years ago, in a conversation with him, he told me that a great many, in fact, probably most of the people who join groups like Al-Qaeda and the likes and the Taliban don't do it for religious fervor. It's an economic decision. The terrorists pay better than anybody else. You can make more money as a mujahid, a holy warrior, than you can as a farmer, a merchant, or working for farmers and merchants. And that's what helped them grow. And this also is what helped Muhammad grow. And this created the model for future generations. Now, he was attacking caravans. He also started to attack communities as well. I'm going to tell you about one of them. One of the things that did change, though, was he no longer killed everybody. See, being that quintessential businessman, he realized there's no money to be made from a corpse. But if you captured someone, you could ransom them if they came from a wealthy family. And there's documents about this that I quote in the book we don't have time to go into now. One time he says, hey, take good care of this one that I just gave to you. His mother's wealthy. You'll get a lot for him. And if you can't do that, you can sell him into slavery. And we'll talk more about that aspect of Islam a little bit later on. Right now, I want to give you just an example, kind of a taste for the true heart of this man of peace that you sometimes hear about. And is the Battle of Bani Qurayza. Bani means tribe of or sons of. Bani Qurayza was an essentially Jewish community. And like many of these other communities, there was a hint that there might be some great treasure hidden there. So, next slide, please. The angel Gabriel came to the apostle wearing an embroidered turban, riding on a mule with a saddle covered with a piece of brocade. You suppose that's how Gabriel presented himself to Mary when he came with the good news that Jesus was coming? Okay, I don't know. Anyway, so Gabriel says, God commands you, Muhammad, to go to Bani Qurayza. I am about to go to them to shake their stronghold, basically to attack and destroy them. So Muhammad faithfully put together another band of warriors and raiders. After a 25-day siege, actually technically in the hadith it says a 25-night siege. I'm not sure why that was. But after a 25-day siege, the Jews of Bani Qurayza sought terms of surrender, hoping to spare as many lives as possible. The Muslims already had a vicious reputation, and these people are saying, maybe we can work some deal to save as many people as possible. Well, here's what this man of peace offered. Next slide, please. The apostle of God, the merciful, the compassionate, ordered, quote, that the men should be killed, the property divided, and the women and children taken as captive. And to save as many lives as they could, the men agreed to it. They were then bound and carted off to Medina. Next slide, please. Then the apostle went out to the market of Medina and dug trenches in it. Then he sent for them, being the captured male Jews, I added that so you should know who they are, and struck off their heads in those trenches as they were brought out to him in batches. There were 600 or 700 in all, though some put the figure as high as 800 or 900. This was a day-long orgy of violence. It started shortly after sunrise. It concluded shortly before 10 p.m. They would be brought out in batches. I don't know what that means. Is it 5, 10, 20? I'm not sure. It doesn't really tell us. And then while Muhammad was there holding court, often applauding, often laughing and cheering, they were beheaded. Somewhere between 600 and 900. One fairly authoritative scholar that I've read said it was right around His information indicates it's probably around 800 men beheaded. Now, a little sidelight on this. Seated next to him during this day-long orgy of violence was a 12-year-old girl. It was not his daughter. It was his wife, Aisha, alleged to be his favorite wife. Now, Aisha had been presented to him by a friend, Abu Bakr, who was also Muhammad's first successor upon his death. He married Aisha when she was 6, maybe 7. You'll see different accounts, but most of them agree to 6. He consummated the marriage when she was 9. And when she was 12, he had her sit beside him to observe all of this. To put it in context, basically he married a first grader, deflowered her when she was a third grader, and as a 12th or as a sixth grader had her sit through this. That's our man of peace. Well, this continued for quite some time until he was ready for, next slide, his triumphal return to Mecca. Next slide, please. About 10 years after being chased out of Mecca, Muhammad returned as a conqueror with a force of about 10,000. So you can see how they have grown. Not long after Mecca was secured, Muhammad's forces continued their religious war of aggression, conquest, submission, plunder, torture, slavery, and murder. You weren't supposed to kill anybody in this holy city of Mecca, but Allah allowed Muhammad to do that when he first took it over. And one of the things he did was he settled scores, people who had ticked him off years before. Now, I'm going to say one more thing about this. This is after about 10 years. If you do the math, it doesn't work out. I'm just quoting to you from the sources. Okay, remember his first revelation was 610. About 13 years in Mecca, it says. So that puts it at 623. 10 years later would be 633. But he died in 632. Oops. So their math is off a little bit, but that's kind of inconsequential. You're gathering this from various sources. The thing is what he did, what he said, the kind of person he was. Okay, next slide, please. At the age of about 62, because we're not sure when he was born, the apostle began to suffer from the illness by which God took him to what honor and compassion he intended for him. So he had an illness during this period of time. Next slide, please. The last injunction the apostle gave was in his words, "Let not two religions be left in the Arabian Peninsula." And then he died on what we would say call June 8, 632. That same spirit applied to the whole world, not just the Arabian Peninsula. Let not two religions be there. He died in Aisha's arms. You'll see later that he said himself, the greatest death is on the battlefield, and to die as a martyr was the greatest honor, and to have a son was a great honor, and none of those things happened. He did have a son, but we'll find out. We'll hear a little bit about that a little bit later on. Okay, let's summarize briefly the life of this man of peace. Next slide, please. Over the course of roughly the last 9 years of Muhammad's life, he personally attended 27 raids. His Muslims conducted another 38 battles and expeditions. This means that Muhammad, man of peace, directed violent actions at a rate of about 1 every 7 weeks, not counting executions and assassinations, and there were a lot of them. Remember, he's the model Muslim, so what did his followers do? Let's see the next slide, please. It has been estimated that Muhammad's Muslims are responsible for the deaths of approximately 270 million people over the last 14 centuries, including about 60 million Christians, 80 million Hindus, 10 million Buddhists, and about 120 million Africans of various religions. Next slide. What kind of a religion could do such a thing? Next slide. Islam. So, let's begin our study of Islam. Next slide, please. The word Islam is an Arabic word that basically means submission or surrender, and that is key to the whole concept of Islam. A faithful Muslim is called a slave of Allah. Jehovah, Abba, has children. Allah has slaves. Muhammad once told a story about angels who had come down here to see how well the slaves were praying. And as you'll see here in a little bit, there's all kinds of rules and regulations and technicalities to see how many points you get for your prayers. So they had come down, they went back up to report to Allah after observing the humans to see how well they had performed their prayers. Allah's greeting to the angels was, in what state did you leave my slaves? Slavery is an integral part of Islam, both internally and externally, as we'll see a little bit later. Next slide, please. In summary, Islam is a ritualistic, works-oriented religion that emphasizes devotion in five key areas. These are known as the five pillars of Islam. Now, let me explain a couple terms. I'm sure you probably know them, but just to clarify. Ritualistic has to do with rituals, which is usually the repetitive saying or doing of certain things. You keep saying the same words in certain circumstances or doing the same thing in certain circumstances. That's rituals. Works-oriented. Virtually every religion on earth, with the exception of Christianity, is works-oriented. In other words, your deeds, your works, is what will get you into either heaven, they say paradise, or hell. Christianity, of course, it's grace. For by grace you have been saved through faith. No, not these other religions, and certainly not Islam. It's what you do and how well you do it. Well, let's look at these five pillars now. Just very briefly, so you're familiar with, you probably heard the expression, what are they talking about? Okay, next slide. These are not in order of importance, for the most part. They are in the order that Bukhari, one of the main traditionists and assembler of Hadith, ordered them. So I'm taking them in his order. But we'll see in just a little bit, we'll get a little insight on what is really important. Now, the first one is the first one. It is the most important. And that's the Shahada. That is the testimony. It means you are to testify that no one has the right to be worshipped except Allah. And of course, remember that linkage we talked about, that Muhammad is Allah's apostle. First and foremost, you must say, it's all about Allah. And of course, Muhammad is his apostle. Next one, please. Then comes the second pillar, the Salat. And this is to offer five daily prayers dutifully and perfectly. So just real quickly, let's see what they're all about. Next slide. The Fajr is performed near dawn. The Zuhr takes place after midday. The Asr is later in the afternoon. The Maghrib is after sunset, and the Isha is after nightfall. The exact timing varies a little bit from group to group. And there are also certain exceptions. Like if you're really involved in something meaningful, like killing us kafirs, and that's the term. You often see it translated as infidel or non-believer. It's from an Arabic word. It means deny or denier. So we are the deniers. We deny the truth of Islam. So we are called kafirs. Actually, that is the denotation, the kind of dictionary definition. There is a connotation to this too. Basically, the term they use to call us infidel, non-believer, or kafir is a vile slur. My apologies, but just so you understand, it's kind of like the N-word on steroids. It is vile. It is disgusting. And when they call us that, they refer to us, that's what they are saying. Okay, so those are the five prayers. There are certain rituals that are involved in this. There's a lot more covered in the book, and the book didn't cover all of them. But if we can see the next slide, please. Ablution is supposed to precede the prayers. That's a ritual cleansing, usually done with water. And there's a prescription on how you do that, and cleaning out your nose from all the dust of the desert. Then there's the Adhan. Now, this is the call to prayer. Maybe you've heard that. This is the kind of mournful wailing you've heard sometimes. But to a Muslim, it's about the most beautiful sound there is. And Muhammad talked about this. In fact, this is a little crude too, but just to give you an idea, Muhammad said that when Satan hears the Adhan, it is so beautiful that he turns on his heels and walks away, passing wind, so he doesn't have to listen to it. Yep, that's Muhammad. And that was repeated several times. I came across that several times in the various hadith. And then there's the Raha. And these are required actions and words to be repeated a prescribed number of times. And again, I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but I think the best way that we Westerners can understand this concept is kind of like the Hail Mary. You know, the Catholics will say, Hail Mary, full of grace, and then they have this whole thing that they say. And I spent some time in a Catholic community, and as I went around with them, it's interesting, at certain times of the day, in certain situations, even moving from one building to another, they had the tradition, they would say three Hail Marys in that situation. So there again, that's part of the ritual. And Islam is rich in ritual. Or you might say shackled by ritual. Okay, next slide, please. The third pillar is the zakat. It's from a term that means, the zakat means that which purifies. It is an obligatory tax, a required tax, that is used for charitable and other religious purposes, but it is not to be spent on kafirs, only Muslims. Now compare this with Christianity. Whenever there's a disaster anywhere in our country, around the world, Christians start giving generously. They don't care whether they're Christians or not. There's a need. They're in trouble. They're hurting. Let's help them. Not the zakat. That's just for Muslims. I will say this, though. It generally consists of about 2.5% of wealth or earnings. I do kind of like their taxation plan. That sounds pretty good to me, 2.5%. Okay, next slide, please. The fourth pillar is the Hajj. It refers to a pilgrimage or a journey. Now, this is the famous journey that they make to Mecca, and they're expected to do it at least once in a lifetime, unless either finances or health prohibits that. So they will make an exemption. Not doing that won't keep you out of paradise, you know, if you have a very good reason. And included in that are certain other rituals like walking around the Kaaba, the cubical building, seven times in a counterclockwise direction, and the symbolic stoning of the devil. They go out in the desert out there, not too far away, and they throw rocks at these three rock pillars, and that's symbolically stoning the devil. And then, next slide, the fifth pillar is the psalm. It means fasting. You probably heard about this too, especially during the month of Ramadan, which just concluded, I think it was July 5th this year. It won't be the same every year. The Muslims use a lunar calendar. The moon has a 29.5-day cycle. So over time, that shifts a little bit every year. So many, many years from now, Ramadan will be in winter. You know. So anyway, but during this, they're required to abstain from eating, drinking, and other pleasures, even in as little as chewing gum, during the month of Ramadan, but only during the day, from sunrise to sunset. I almost said, and in the nighttime they could go hog wild and pig out, but that would be too, be kind of, no, go there. Okay. Do you know how they feel about pork and pigs? Okay, now, these are, in a nutshell, the five pillars. I would argue, though, there is a sixth pillar, and I'll document why. And that the sixth pillar does have a rank order, and it is second only to the shahala, the testimony. And that is, next slide, please, jihad. Now, why do I say this? First of all, understand that jihad does not mean holy war. They have a different word for war. It means sacred struggle. It does not have to necessarily be fighting, but it usually will support fighting in one way or another. For example, Muhammad once said that somebody who just provides grain for a mujahid or a holy warrior's horse is a jihadist. You're helping out the fighters. Okay? So in modern terms, you write a check to an organization that somehow ends up funding some terrorists or something like that. You are a jihadist. You tell lies that support the advance of Islam. You are a jihadist. Okay? Now, why do I say this is one of the pillars, and in fact, the second most important one? Well, actually, I didn't. Muhammad did. Let's see the next slide, and we'll see why. Now, obviously, in a works-oriented religion, you're very concerned about what's going to get you points. You want to collect as many points as possible so you can go to paradise. So, obviously, Muhammad was often asked, hey, what's going to get me the most bang for the buck, the most points? And so we find this in multiple hadith also. Somebody comes to Muhammad and asks like this one, and this one from Bukhari. Allah's apostle was asked, what is the best deed? He, Muhammad, replied, to believe in Allah and his apostle, Muhammad. That's number one, right? The testimony, shahala. The questioner then asked, what is the next in goodness? Again, I didn't put these in here. Bukhari did over 1,000 years ago. He replied, to participate in jihad, religious fighting in Allah's cause. The questioner again asked, what is the next in goodness? And he replied, to perform Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca. Look at that. The testimony is the most important. Next comes jihad. And then comes the Hajj, and then presumably come the other three. That's how important and integral jihad is in Islam. If somebody tells you, oh, that's just the nut jobs out there, no, it is absolutely integral and essential, and we're going to back that up with some more quotes, to show you just how important it is and how important it is for every Muslim to participate, not just the nut jobs, the extremists. Let's see the next slide, please. Muhammad said, two angels descend from paradise each day. One says, O Allah, reward those who contribute to jihad. And the other says, O Allah, kill those who refuse to support jihad. It's not a matter of bless those who support jihad and, you know, maybe don't bless the others as much. No, kill them. Kill them. Kill them if they don't support jihad. Next slide, please. Fighting is absolutely an integral, essential part of Islam. Allah's apostle said, I have been ordered by Allah to fight against the people until they testify that none has the right to be worshipped but Allah and that Muhammad is Allah's apostle. You knew that was coming, right? That linkage again. Notice, I have been ordered to fight. What did Jesus say? He sent the disciples out. Teach them. What if they don't accept? Fight them? Cut off their heads? No. Shake the dust off your feet and go on. Big difference, huh? Next slide, please. The glorification of war and martyrdom is an essential part of Islam. It is inextricable. You can't take this out of Islam any more than you can take the wet out of water. It is essential. As Muhammad said, the best death is on the battlefield. The best death is on the battlefield. It was a death that was denied Muhammad, though. He died curled up in Aisha's arms. Let's look at the next slide to see how integral this is again. This is from the Quran, Surah 8, verse 12. Allah, this is God's talking, I will cast terror into the hearts of those who disbelieve, therefore strike off their heads and strike off every fingertip of them. Well, by golly, if God himself is a terrorist, what can you expect from his disciples? The Muslim God is a terrorist. Now, let's be honest about this. There are places in the Old Testament where God says, I will strike terror in the hearts of Israel's enemies, right? Are they the same? No. Allah will strike terror in the hearts of anybody who just disbelieves. Jehovah said, you're fighting my people. You are doing evil. You are burning your children. You are committing all kinds of outrages. That's why I'm coming after you, but not just because you haven't accepted me. Big difference. Next slide, please. Again, in the glorification of martyrdom, we see this over and over and over again. Again, that classic brainwashing technique, repeat, repeat, repeat. Here are just a few examples. And obviously, if fighting is a big part of your success, then you want to make sure your warriors are well motivated. Even to the point of death. That's one of the biggest things we humans have to overcome, right? The fear of death. So how do you motivate them to overcome the fear of death? And there's lots of stories, including some of the book, that tell about how these people joyfully accepted their own death. Even with a spear going through them, they're happy. Well, here's why. Muhammad over and over again talked about some men whom God honored with martyrdom. God honored several with martyrdom. Perhaps God will favor him with martyrdom. God honored with martyrdom. Over and over and over, he's just brainwashing him. It is an honor, it is an honor, it is an honor. And not only that, it is an instant trip to paradise. Now, just a little aside here. We've had cases where, like the guys who flew the planes into the Twin Towers, we know a little bit about their life. They were doing very non-Islamic things, going to bars, drinking, stuff like that. So some people deduce from that, they weren't very good Muslims, so this isn't real Islam here. The nut that just recently rented a truck and started mowing down people over in Nice, he had all kinds of problems. He wasn't living a model Islamic life, so some people might deduce, well, see, those aren't real Muslims. Oh, yes, they are. Think about the dynamic here. If you're living in a works-related religion where your chance to go to heaven only depends on your good deeds and you just don't have it in you to do enough of that, you just aren't disciplined enough, what's your one and only chance to go to heaven? Get martyred. Kill kafirs. Instant trip to paradise. So yes, it is consistent. Next slide, please. This is revealing too. Muhammad said, "By him in whose hands my life is, I would love to be martyred in Allah's cause and then get resurrected, and then get martyred, and then get resurrected again, and then get martyred, and then get resurrected again, and then get martyred." The celebration of death. Oh, the best thing that happened is I got killed serving Allah, and then he resurrected me so I could do it again, and do it again, and do it again, and do it again. That's what they're teaching. That is how integral this all is. And another thing here, because we're getting ready to transition into another important area for you to understand the Muslim mindset, is in the next slide. Muhammad cried out, "Jihad is deceit." And in another place, "War is deceit." Deceit is deception. It is lying. According to Islam, it's okay to lie, as long as you're lying to kafirs and as long as you're lying to advance the cause of Allah and Islam. Keep that in mind, because now we're going to make a transition and start to talk about the Islamic mindset and something called Islamic dualism. But first, let's look at the next slide. Lying to a kafir, one of us, in order to advance the cause of Islam is good. In fact, they even have official terms for it. One of them is taqiya. Taqiya means righteous deceit or sacred deception, which is practice against kafirs. I'll give you an example in a minute. Another one is kitman, which is a partial truth. I'll give you an example of a minute. Okay, what would be an example of taqiya? Well, the word taqiya is used mostly by Shiites that are kind of the minority group of Muslims. But the concept is accepted by the Sunnis as well, who are the majority part. So the concept is Islamic. So, I don't know, let's just take a hypothetical here to grab out of thin air. Let's say there was some, I don't know, maybe a Shiite nation in the Middle East, and they were sitting on gazillion tons of fossil fuels. They didn't have any worries whatsoever about energy into the near future, but they wanted to develop a nuclear program. And some people thought, I wonder if they're doing it to develop a bomb, but they said, no, we would never do that. We're doing it for energy purposes. Even though we're sitting on a gazillion tons of oil and we have absolutely no worries about energy for the next, 300 years or something like that. Taqiya. And you would think that if you had, national leaders who were well-versed in Islam, they would understand this and wouldn't be snookered by them. Kitman, a partial truth. Oh, Islam is a peaceful religion. Yes, it is. It is, I'm telling you, in all honesty, it is. If you accept their definition of peace. We'll get to that here in just a minute. So a partial truth, a half truth. Well, with that, let's get into our next section. Next slide, please, which is Islamic dualism. Now here again, we're going to talk about the Islamic mindset. And you have to understand this. Really, you have to understand this or you will be snookered yourself by them. They'll be able to spin a very deceptive web. Remember, jihad is deceit. And you can easily get fooled if you don't understand these things. Next slide, please. Islam does not hold that there is one universal code of conduct that applies to everyone in all circumstances. A particular deed is not necessarily good nor bad just because it is. Circumstances dictate morality, and especially the Muslim and kafir circumstance. Now, we here in the Judeo-Christian tradition have the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. And it says, thou shalt this, and thou shalt not that. This is good, this is bad. Do this, don't do that. Notice there are no asterisks in there, are there? It doesn't say this is good, unless. It doesn't say that's bad, except. No, good, bad, period, case closed. Not in Islam. Now, I think one of the best ways we can illustrate this is through Jesus' golden rule. Next slide, please. And a passage that I found that I'm calling Muhammad's golden rule. Now, Jesus' golden rule, depending on the translation, is pretty much the same thing. So in everything, do unto others as you would have them do to you. This sums up the law and the prophets. Or maybe as we may have learned it as kids, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. In other words, treat other people the way you want to be treated. Which others? All others, right? It doesn't matter if you know them or you don't know them. It doesn't matter if they're a friend or an enemy. You treat them with respect. Right? But not so with Muhammad. Next slide, please. Now, he didn't call it this, but I am, because it's so closely parallels, but with a very significant little difference in there. The prophet said, none of you will have faith till he wishes for his Muslim brother what he likes for himself. Again, I did not put Muslim in there. Bukhari did to make sure you understood properly. So, what this means is, treat other brother Muslims the way you want to be treated. Anybody else? Hey. No holds barred. Next slide, please. Let's look at the translation then. Here's the practical translation. There isn't much you shouldn't do for a brother Muslim. There isn't much you cannot do to a kafir, including lying, stealing, torturing, enslaving, and killing. Now, remember that Muslim in parentheses that I said Bukhari put in there? I have seen some writings from people who are trying to soft pedal the danger of Islam. They leave that out to make it look like Muhammad's golden rule and Jesus' golden rule are the same. Very, very critical difference. Well, how do you justify this? How can you justify a God that makes this distinction? Well, let's look at the next slide. Because God loveth not the unbelievers. Allah does not love you until you become a believer, until you become a Muslim. Compare that with Christianity. We have verses that basically say that God loved you when you were still an enemy of His, when you were not a believer, when you were rebelling against Him, when you're doing all manner of vile things, God still loves you. Not Allah. He hates you. And until you become one of His Muslims, you'll continue to be hated, and anything and everything can be done to you. It's fair game. Next slide, please. So whereas the God of the Bible loved all people so much that He sacrificed His only begotten Son to save them, the God of the Quran decreed that, quote, those who fight against God, Allah, and His messenger, Muhammad, shall be slaughtered or crucified, or their hands and feet shall alternately be struck off, or they shall be banished from the land. Quran 5:33. Now, what about this business? Here's Kitman, example of Islam is a religion of peace. Again, the Muslim apologists will point to certain verses in there to support that. And here's one of them. Next slide, please. This is from the Quran. And fight in the way of God with those who fight with you, but aggress not. God loves not the aggressor. Okay, that sounds pretty much like what we believe when you stop and think about it, right? St. Augustine and others came up with the concepts of a righteous war. And certainly there are righteous wars. God fought enough of them in the Old Testament. And He ordered others. So yeah, under some circumstances. So this sounds kind of okay. If you have to fight in the way of God. In other words, for something that matters to God and in a way that would please God. But don't start it. Don't be the aggressor because God doesn't love the aggressor. Okay, that sounds pretty agreeable. And if you don't understand the Muslim mindset, you will get schnookered. You will get fooled. Because a Muslim looks at it very differently. Now, as we'll see later on, Muslims are only obligated to give you three choices. Convert, be enslaved, or die. Convert, be enslaved, or die. And I'll show you the documentation for that a little bit later on. Convert, be enslaved, or die. Make sure you remember that. It's critical. Now, you say, well, they're not doing that in America. And that's because they're such a small percentage of the population. They're in no position to carry it out. They've carried it out throughout history. How do you think they got that 270 million dead and millions more enslaved? Convert, be enslaved, or die. But here's the thing, and so this is one of those elements of the Islamic mindset, the Muslim mindset you need to understand. When a Muslim walks up to you and offers you the opportunity to convert and you graciously decline, you just committed an act of aggression. No matter how nice you are, Imagine I'm Ahmed and I say, hey, I've got a really good deal for you. This Islam stuff is wonderful and I want you to join our family and be a part of that. And you say, well, thank you very much, Ahmed, but you know, I'm really happy as a Christian. It just gives me a warm feeling and I believe in the truth of it. But thank you anyway. I wish you well. You just committed an act of aggression. You just spit in Allah's face. They see that as an act of aggression. Therefore, they can do anything to you now. You started it. You started it. Next slide, please. So anyone who refuses the offer to convert has already aggressed against Allah, and therefore fighting back is defensive. Now let's see the next slide here. There's a certain circular reasoning, too, that goes around with this business of Islam as a peaceful nation. When Muslims tell you that, they are dead serious. But again, it has to do with the definition of peace. In the West, when we talk about peace, we usually think about an absence of war. There's other definitions, too, like I'm in peace with my decision. You know? But usually we're talking about the absence of war. Not so much in the Middle East. They often have a broader, more expansive concept of peace. Good example, Hebrew, shalom. It's usually, that word is usually translated as one word, peace. But when a Jew says to you, shalom, he's not saying, gee, I hope you don't have to go to war today. He's saying, I wish you the very best in every aspect of your life. It is a broad-based, beautiful blessing. Well, the Islamic concept of peace is a little different as well. The Islamic concept of peace is anything that advances the interests of Islam. So is Islam a religion of peace? Well, by definition, anything that advances it is peaceful. So hijacking a plane and flying it into a skyscraper and killing thousands of people, if it advances the interest of Islam, it's peaceful. Strapping on a suicide vest, walking into a children's playground and killing yourself and a few dozen others, or into a marketplace, if it advances the cause of Islam, it's peaceful. So anything that advances the interest of Islam is considered peaceful, including beheadings, immolations, crucifixions, bombings, kidnapping, enslaving, making wide the slaughter among them from the Quran. So all those nuts out there, those extremists out there like ISIS, the things they're doing, it's right out of Muhammad's playbook. It's right out of the Quran, the Hadith, and Surat Rasul Allah. Well, we're going to take a break right now for a couple of reasons. Give you a little time to stretch, wake up, whatever. The bathrooms, the double doors there, the first double doors on the right, men's room first when you come to, ladies' room second when you come to. There are also some refreshments back there, so feel free to get that. We're only going to take about a 5-10 minute break, and then we're going to go into the next part. And the next part we're going to begin with, next slide, please. Next slide, please. Well, there, Islamic relationships. One of the keys for understanding and defining almost any religion is how it talks about relationships with God and with each other. And we're going to see how the Muslims see that. So about 5 to 10 minutes, I'm going to get something quick to eat, drink, be merry, and we'll continue. Thank you.